are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, August 16th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. Sitting here in my soft-collared shirt. Michael's taking a break from Adidas.
Indeed. Well, it's Casual Friday.
Right.
So I'm out of my gym attire.
Your work attire.
Indeed.
On the program today, Ben Dixon from the Benjamin Dixon Show will be joining us. And Andy Kindler from The World
Jewish Comedy
will be joining us. Also on the program today, Israel bans two sitting Congress people from the United States to visit in an official capacity at Donald Trump's behest or encouragement. And meanwhile, Donald Trump wants to buy Greenland. Can't. Also on the program, Corey Lewandowski subpoenaed by the Judiciary Committee in the House over the obstruction questions. And recession talks loom, or I should say recession talk looms. An appeals court orders Trump to provide hygiene products to migrant child prisoners.
Contemplate that that is a win, how sick our situation is.
Exactly.
Meanwhile, dozens of soon-to-be filed suits, will claim that kidnapped migrant children were abused in foster care. The State Department Inspector General claims that top State Department officials were attacking its own staff based on their staff's politics. Lastly, Trump appointed Pennsylvania U.S. attorney on the attack against the criminal justice reformer, Philly's DA Larry Krasner. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. I am broadcasting from a retreat headed north towards the fair city the cities in central Massachusetts, I should probably say. But thank you for joining us. Another end of the week in this era. It is, of course, August, theoretically the slowest time of the year in terms of news, and it is proving to be so to a certain extent. Donald Trump has started his campaign. He's out campaigning. The Democratic campaign is in full swing. We will not have another debate, though, for at least, I think, about 3.5 weeks now in late September. So we will be, of course, covering all of that. And just a reminder, for those of you who join us only on Fridays, you can become a member of this program and support the show by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. We give you extra content every day. And on top of obviously the show that we provide, the non-fun half of the show that we provide every day.
The austere half.
Right, exactly. And also, remind you, check out the AM Quickie. We are going to go on vacation in about a week, in a couple of days. And we have all new content every day. I think it is right now. We have I've done 6 interviews in prep for this. And but if you want the news of the day, subscribe, go to iTunes, sign up for the Majority Report through whatever podcast, audio podcast service you have, and check out the AM Quickie. It is in that feed. We're going to separate it and send it off to its own feed in September. But for now, you got to go to the Majority Report feed to get it. So obviously, the bigger story today is the story revolving around what's happening with two congresswomen, Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, who have been banned from Israel. Apparently this morning or earlier, this morning in terms of U.S. time, the Israeli government said that Tlaib could go and visit her grandmother, who is in her 90s, but in a very narrow circumstances and in a way that is disregards her status as a U.S. congresswoman. And I think it's easy to get bogged down in the supposed, you know, politics going back and forth on this. But when you step back, the implications of this are pretty stunning. It's understandable, I would think, that some countries would ban U.S. lawmakers from visiting. We have some hostile relationships with some countries. It is understandable, I guess, on some level, you know, broadly speaking, if a country did not have good relations with us as to why they would ban it. I mean, that seems quite obvious. We ban probably officials from Iran or from North Korea. But that is not the relationship that we have with Israel. Here is Bernie Sanders saying what is both stunningly obvious and, because of the nature of our politics in this country, going to be deemed as being somewhat controversial. But this is the most obvious response that one could possibly give to this situation. Play this.
Senator, good to see you. What's your reaction to President Trump asking the president of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, to do this and Netanyahu obliging?
Well, I wish I could tell you, Ali, that I am shocked. I am not. We have a president who tragically is a racist, is a xenophobe, and who is a religious bigot. But the idea that a member of the United States Congress cannot visit a nation, which, by the way, we support to the tune of billions and billions of dollars, is clearly an outrage. And if Israel doesn't want members of the United States Congress to visit their country to get a firsthand look at what's going on, and I've been there many, many times. But if he doesn't want members to visit, maybe he can respectfully decline the billions of dollars that we give to Israel.
Yeah, I mean, but honestly, I mean, think about
100% right.
Think about the outrage there would be if, I don't know, Egypt said we're going to ban entry from a couple of Republican lawmakers.
Or how about, more to the point, 2 Jewish lawmakers.
Right, right. I mean, that would be stunning. And the idea that, I mean, look, is there absolutely no strings attached to having relations with the United States? To having diplomatic relations? Is there absolutely no strings attached to the billions of dollars that we use to support Israel? I mean, this is, it's pretty outrageous. And of course, it was encouraged by Donald Trump We'll talk more about this with Ben Dixon, but
I just have to. Sorry, I'm sorry. Just real quick, I, you know, every time I see, this is another time again where it just really needs to be underlined that Bernie is by far the clearest and the most brave on this, because the other sort of critiques I've seen of, you know, Senator Warren said that this undermines their you know image as a tolerant democracy. They're not. I mean, we just need to stop having pretend conversations about Israel. It's there are too many people whose lives have been lost. There's too much repression to keep having a fantasy life about this place. And it's wrong. And it's also quite wrong, by the way, to the handful of people left in Israel who are trying to fight for some semblance of open society as well, frankly.
Right. All right. Well, we'll talk more about that with Ben Dixon. And we should maybe go over, like, you know, what BDS is. I mean,
yes.
Like, you know, from an official standpoint, I have no doubt there are people who are associated with BDS who have their own opinions as to what it is, like people who are associated with the Democratic Party have a different notion of what it is, or anything. But right. Well, but it's true. But like, you know, there is an official statement of the organization of BDS, and it's demonized, I think, by people who don't know what it is. We'll talk more about with Ben Dixon on this, because I actually think this is going to be helpful for that movement in many respects. But we will, like I say, we'll talk to Ben Dixon about that in a moment. Folks, I know many of you are busy. I am one of those people who are also busy. And one of the ways that I deal with my busyness is I try and get my reading in on stuff that isn't necessarily stuff that you wouldn't necessarily need to, like, read all of the sort of nuance, right? I'm not saying anything about anybody's specific books, but a lot of nonfiction books, you know, you want the key takeaways. Well, if you feel like you can't find the time to read all the books on your list, you're not alone. Blinkist. It's an app that compiles the key takeaways from thousands of nonfiction books. They're adding titles. They seem to be adding titles constantly. Everything you want to know about a book, nonfiction book, is condensed down into 15 minutes that you can read and now listen to as well. Blinkist is really unique. It works on your phone, your tablet, your web browser, whatever it is. You find everything from health to self-help titles to how to history books now that they're starting to go into. They're going into business books, obviously. All of it in Blinkist's library. For me, I have to say, like, and I think it was appropriate, right? But I went through the 4-hour work week, that Tim Ferriss.
It's a great book. It's something we all aspire to.
Yes, honestly. And then, you know, like, the thing is that, like, I don't know, and I don't, if I saw The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, that's not a book that I would pick up and read, because I'm like, I'm just not going to make that kind of commitment.
But you read a summary of it.
But I listened to a 15-minute summary of it, and I think I probably took away, I probably said, screw about 6 of them, but I'm taking one. But the point is that
there was 3 minutes of great material there.
There's a lot of stuff that you look through the ideas, you know, what they offer on these things, like, you know, like, I don't, the power of habit and other things like that, that I would be. The other one is the 80-20 principle. That one has been sort of a guiding light for me. And I first heard about it via Tim Ferriss, and then I just checked it out on Blinkist. Would I read that book? In all honesty, I would not. But I listened to a 15-minute a condensed version of it, because the bar to entry is so low. With Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books. All the book you want, and all for one low price. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer for Majority Report listeners. Go to Blinkist.com/majority You can start a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/majority. Get a 7-day free trial. Check it out. I think you'll like it. I think you will. Also, with more than 70 sizes, including their signature half cup sizes, Third Love designs bras with breast size and shape in mind for a perfect fit and premium feel. All you got to do, you go in and you answer a couple of simple questions. Third Love has this fit finder, you know, quiz. They find your perfect fit within 60 seconds. And then Third Love has a 100% fit guarantee. You can wear, wash, and put your bra to the test for 60 days. If you don't love it, you can return it after 60 days. Third Love will wash it and donate it to a woman in need. This is hands down, I've been told, the most comfortable bra you'll own. Straps that won't slip, tagless labels, lightweight, super thin memory foam cups. Our resident Majority Report bra tester had this to say: I like that they don't have a zillion options, so it's easy to choose something quickly. The fit is great. Usually I have to return most bras I order online, even though they're in my size. I ordered two, both fit. That almost never happens. Super comfortable for an everyday bra. Not as boring as most t-shirt bras. Subtle and cute details, so I don't feel basic. There you have it, folks. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone. So right now, they're offering my listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/majority now to find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/majority for 15% off today. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ben Dixon from The Benjamin Dixon Show.
People try to put us to death. Just because we get around.
Talking about my generation.
Things they do look awful.
Talking about my generation.
I hope I die before I get old.
Talking about my generation.
Just my generation, baby. Why don't you all fade away? Try to dig what we all say. I'm not trying to cause a big sensation. I'm just talking about my generation. We all
All right, folks, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. We had a little bit of Who there, of course, to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. 50 years. Nuts that it took place 50 years ago. I mean, I wasn't there, but I was not at Woodstock 99 either. I was not at any of them, but I've listened to all the music, and it wasn't, you know, when I was a kid, it was just a big festival that happened, you know, I don't know, 10, 12 years earlier or something. But in the meantime, folks, he is not at Woodstock. He is, in the he is below the Mason-Dixon line, if I'm not mistaken, and maybe no relation, or maybe there is. Ladies and gentlemen, Ben Dixon of the Benjamin Dixon Show. Ben, it never occurred to me. Is that, are you?
You know, well, funny how that works out. It's very possible I could be related to Mason, the Dixon part of Mason-Dixon, but I wouldn't know. For reasons that we don't have to discuss right now.
I understand. Fair enough. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Benjamin Dixon, it never occurred to me either. I honestly, the first time I ever thought about it was when you mentioned it just now.
Really?
Yeah, seriously.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. Well, all right. Well, there it is. Maybe next time you're on, you'll have something to report to us.
Yeah, I'll get some kind of ancestry.com or something. We'll figure it out.
All right. Well, so let's get into this. I mean, obviously, in some respects, I think the story that implicates more people, and maybe we'll start with that as opposed to what's going on with Tlaib and Ilhan Omar. I mean, because I think that's a big story. But at the beginning of the week, the Trump administration announced essentially that a policy change, a rules change that will impact, I mean, potentially at a minimum about 350,000 immigrants, but potentially millions.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody's quite sure, because the impact of this regulation, this new law, essentially, will not just have direct bearing on people, but will have sort of subsidiary effects, because it's going to scare a lot of people.
Right.
And this is people who are here legally trying to get a more permanent resident status.
Right.
And they need to basically be at 250% of poverty, with, of course, assurances from family and whatnot, to get there. I mean, this is a direct assault on
right.
on people who are living 150% above poverty level, who have kids, who have family, who have husbands, wives. I mean, it's this is the Republican Party basically fulfilling the promise to their people, which is we're going to have a whiter America.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, Sam, I actually honestly forgot that happened this week. It's been that kind of a news cycle week. But it really stood out the most to me with Ken Cuccinelli and his approach to his interpretation on the poem, on the side of the Emma Lazarus poem, on the side of the Statue of Liberty. But this is directly fulfilling the promise for a whiter America. It's not as though the process to get into America was easy to begin with. But now they're making the hurdles so much higher that only the wealthy would be able to come. And then, of course, with everything else, it's the chilling effect, right? Everything else that Donald Trump is doing, it's very clear that the only immigrants that they want are, like Ken Cuccinelli said, he referenced the European descent,
right,
when he was talking about the Emma Lazarus poem. So they're fulfilling the promises of the far right. And this is what they wanted. And Donald Trump, I actually, you know, you got to give it to him. He's delivering exactly what they have wanted for some time, but haven't been bold enough to actually go out there and do it. It's a combination. It's a combination of all of the tactics that he's doing that I agree with you 100%. It's going to have a more of a chilling effect on top of everything else. So even if immigrants of color are capable of meeting that threshold, you know, they really are disincentivized in coming to America. That's what they want.
And they're making it harder for people who are here. I mean, when you step back now, look, this is one of those things where an incoming president who's not Donald Trump can reverse this on day one. I mean, can literally reverse it on day one. And,
yep.
You know, at least in terms of instructions, there's still you're creating a culture in these agencies that is already bad to begin with, that already has, you know, ICE contractors driving their trucks into peaceful protesters.
Right.
Like we saw the other day. I mean, so this is the nature of this agency, and it's going to take, you know, years in many respects to sort of like, and I really, that's why I think they should really just take it down, take the agency out, reconstruct something that functions in a different way with different personnel, different management structure and whatnot. But at least theoretically on day one, this is something that a president could change. It's going to cause a tremendous amount of suffering, of angst amongst wide swaths of people. But your point about Donald Trump delivering, you know, I mean, I'm old enough to remember 3 years ago where there was this big question as to what was going on with Trump voters. Were they voting out of economic anxiety or something else? Now, undoubtedly, there are people who the economic anxiety makes them more susceptible to looking for a scapegoat, makes them more willing to scapegoat people. Obviously, that is obviously the case. And it may very well be the case that there are small subsets of people that you could win over from Trump with a policy set that I happen to and I think you do too, subscribe to. You may bring those voters over. I don't know, but it's very likely you would. But the bottom line is Donald Trump knows what it's going to take to satisfy his voters. And he's doing it. He's not doing the other part, but he's doing this part.
Right, right. He's delivering on what Adam Suhr, he's renowned for now at this point. The cruelty is the point. Yep. This is what they want. This is what they enjoy. Now, yeah, I agree with you. There's going to be a small subset of people who were voting for Trump because of economic anxiety, but it's a very small subset because we see now that, you know, he has not reversed. He has not addressed it. He has not provided anything to address their economic anxiety, economic angst. And yet still he has glowing support in the Republican Party. I mean, they're still supporting him. Here's what I was concerned about when you were saying the next president can come in and reverse these things. Donald Trump is pulling serious crowds. And not just serious crowds, but motivated, highly motivated crowds.
Yes.
They're not disillusioned whatsoever. They are motivated for this next election every step of the way. Donald Trump is like the ultimate, the penultimate cheerleader. He knows how to rile up a crowd and get the audience. And those people are going to go out there enthusiastically voting, not because of their economic anxiety, but because of the type of vitriol Donald Trump feeds them. It's the red meat game. Donald Trump mastered that, and that's why he was able to take over the Republican Party.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion by any stretch that we're going to have a different president. I'm increasingly worried, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about the race, although there was not a lot happening this week. Mm-hmm. But I'm increasingly worried that, Joe Biden's going to end up being the nominee and is in absolutely no shape to win, despite the fact that my thinking 6 months ago that just about every Democrat who was, a major candidate could win. He scares me in particular because he has, I don't want to get sidetracked, but when you talk about, Donald Trump having a highly motivated base and Joe Biden selling himself as the antithesis to Donald Trump, he is particularly in that regard.
Exactly. That's good.
He does not have a highly motivated base
at all.
Yeah. He just has people who have some broad sentiment and wishing that they could return to a past that in many respects never was. But let's leave that aside for the moment. I mean, so I am encouraged on some level in that we, regardless of what happens, although I have yet to see it really in amongst the candidates or, frankly, any part of the Democratic leadership, a cohesive response to immigration. Mm. I mean, we need to have an immigration policy. It needs to deal with people in this country who are here without documentation. We need to have an overarching set of principles that need to be articulated. And the only upshot to any of this is that the polarization that is cutting towards, more and more Republicans becoming anti-immigrant on some level, at least a more fervent anti-immigrant stance, is that broadly speaking, the American public is becoming more pro-immigrant, is becoming more open to simply providing citizenship, right? Because no one's walking around now and saying, like, I feel much better about the country now that the people on that temporary protected status are out of the way. There's just so much more elbow room here.
Right. Here's my question for you. I'm curious, though, if that if Donald Trump didn't provide what they needed to stay motivated, and if there's actually anything that the Democrats could offer that would motivate us. So, I mean, obviously, we're motivated to bring Donald Trump's tyranny over immigration to an end. But I'm curious, do you think there's a policy that Democrats could actually forward that would motivate their base the way Donald Trump's hatred motivates his base?
I don't think so. I mean, I think there are policies that would provide maybe, certainly in the Hispanic and Latinx communities, I would imagine that a more comprehensive set of policies would probably help motivate folks in that community. I think broadly speaking, you know, there's so many issues, it seems to me, within the Democratic umbrella of people, right? The center, left, center, I don't know. Obviously, the more to the left, the more so I think like politically invested you are. And you tend to have more issues that will drive enthusiasm. But for those people who are just like broadly on this in the center left, I think people are just looking for, like, I want policies that just work and are humane. Like, don't make me feel like, oh, my God, we're kidnapping children and sending them to foster homes where they're getting abused. Oh, my God, why do we have to have a court say kids should have soap and toothpaste and the ability to clean themselves if we're detaining them? And why are we detaining them? Unless we can't find their parents, you know, like, I mean, I think the vast majority of Americans just simply want that. And I don't think that they're looking for a specific policy that they could articulate, because I just don't think they're that heavily invested in the issue, which is the point, is that which is immigrants, broadly speaking, help this country. And broadly speaking, are a net gain to the country and don't implicate anybody's lives, you know, except for their own and their families, just like everybody else. You know what I mean?
Right,
like that's that to me seems to be, you know, and so I don't know that there is a policy, but it's much easier to respond to one. And frankly, we just simply need to have one being expressed by the Democrats so that there can be some formula and even a negotiation stance and even, you know, some type of like watershed for people to simply say like, yeah, I agree with that. Like right now I could say I agree with that, but I wouldn't even know what that is.
And I think that's one of the structural problems that we have on. And when I say the left, I mean broadly, really wide spectrum from the Nancy Pelosi's of the world all the way over to Marxist Leninists. One of the problems we have on the left is that we don't have, particularly with immigration, we don't have the ability to forward a policy that fuels anger. And one of the most potent things that motivating factors in politics in general is always anger. The best that we have right now with regard to immigration, and it's just off, you know, just kind of talking. I could be dead wrong about this, but I do think it's a reaction to Donald Trump's hatred that is going to be the most motivating thing, is because we are in some obscene times. Like, this is absurd. The fact that everything that you outlined, the child abuse that's taking place, the fact that a court had to say, give these children sanitary items, you know, those types of things is what motivates us. But look at the arsenal that Donald Trump has. Like, he has a full arsenal of policy issues that fuel anger. It's like they're already winning, right? They're winning elections, but he's able to maintain a steady supply of hatred and anger over the last 2 or 3 years, all the way to the next election. And that's why he's able to get these crowds out the way he's getting it. And so we really do have to figure out what our policy positions are. But at the same time, we really have to look structurally, like how are we going to motivate ourselves if we're not, if our brains aren't designed like conservatives to be motivated by anger? We're at a disadvantage, and Donald Trump knows that. And I think that's one of the reasons we have to be very leery about this upcoming election. We have to be really keep our eyes on it because it's not a foregone conclusion.
Oh, yeah, I know. I agree with you. I mean, I think there are policies that motivate people on the left. I think fixing health care is something that is highly, motivates people on the left. I mean, when you think of even the objections within the Democratic Party that are stated towards something like a Medicare for All proposal, it's all basically, for the most part, that's too ambitious. We can't do that. Or it's not, we need, if, you know, that's, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, right?
Right.
As opposed to that's a bad idea. It's just like, we're not ready for it. It's going to be too hard. And then as you move to the right, you get things like, people are going to be upset about losing their, private health insurance. Mm-hmm. No, they won't.
Mm-hmm.
No, they won't. Because they're not going to be left with nothing. They're going to be left with something that's better. I mean, it's just absurd. I mean, there are, I think, legitimate things to be concerned about with that need to be dealt with. But broadly speaking, that's not one of them. That's a consistent problem between the right and the left, is that the left has the right has a Masada complex and the left does not. And so, but we should also say, just to touch base, because I know folks don't listen throughout the week, and in our current news environment, we don't hear stuff like this, but the Endangered Species Act is under assault by the Trump administration. The way the EPA is decided to pursue this, oil and drilling contracts are going to supersede species that are on the endangered list of extinction, at least in this country. The EPA has been, his relentless attack on the administrative state is the other thing that they promised that they're also delivering, I think, in many different ways. But all right, let's talk about what's going on with Israel. And we should say this is being done with the backdrop of the State Department Inspector General released a report today, or maybe it was yesterday, saying that State Department officials are actively harassing people within the State Department that they feel are not loyal to President Trump. I know it.
It was a. Christ, I'm just hearing this for the first time. My God.
Well, I guess the report was obtained in advance by Politico. It singles out the Assistant Secretary of State, the Department's Bureau of International Organization Affairs, as failing to stop misbehavior despite numerous complaints. The Trump's political appointees have retaliated against career State Department employees. This is just nuts, but also indicative of the day of the age. So, all right, let's talk about this. Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, two congresswomen planning to go to Israel. They had planned the trip with, I think, one other person, with a Stacey Plaskett. She's a non-voting congressional representative of the U.S. Virgin Islands. They were going on a 4-day fact-finding tour to examine the condition of Palestinians under Israeli occupation. They're all Democrats. They wanted to focus on the effects of policy moves by the Trump administration, including aid cuts to East Jerusalem hospitals and Palestinian refugees and the move of the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. And then Netanyahu basically said they're banned because of their support for BDS. I sort of feel like BDS has become this boogeyman And people don't really know what it is, but it's basically boycotts, divestment, and sanctions. And let me just say up front, to the extent that I have any issues with what they're doing, I think some of the academic institution stuff in terms of the boycotts may be a little bit harsh because you are, I feel like you're hurting an opportunity to get, but that's more of like a tactical thing. And but boycotting support from, you know, sporting events, cultural events, academic institutions, from Israeli and international companies engaged in violations of Palestinian human rights. Divestment campaigns ask for banks, local councils, churches, pension funds, universities to withdraw investments from the state of Israel and all Israeli and international companies that sustain what they call the Israeli apartheid. That's certainly not terribly controversial, even amongst many Israeli politicians, as to the way that they perceive that system there. Sanctions pressure governments to fulfill their legal obligations to end Israeli apartheid and not aid. So there really are no sanctions, as far as I know, against Israel, at least in, you know, broadly international ones. But none of this stuff is terribly distinct from what I remember the divestiture or divestment movement in the 80s, right, against South Africa. I don't think that, you know, I certainly don't think South Africa, you know, banned any Congress people from the United States to go in there. I mean, this seems to me to be the reasonable sort of the so-called reasonable response that people have been calling for the Palestinian people, that people saying all the time, like, where are the Palestinians, Gandhi, et cetera, et cetera. Well, if there was a Palestinian Gandhi, and there's been leaders, they've been jailed. This is the type of thing that they would promote, it seems to me.
Right. Right. One of the few arguments that I've heard actually articulated against BDS is the motivation behind the originators of the movement being one of wanting to see the destruction of Israel. That's is the best, the most articulated. I can't say the best, but it's the most well articulated argument that I've heard anyone make. Outside of that, which in a way could be a stretch. Outside of that, I literally don't understand how we in America can, you know, attempt to pass laws that make it illegal to boycott another nation,
right,
or boycott a particular issue. And it's very difficult to talk about this issue in particular for all of the minds that you would step on just in this talking about Israel in the first place, because they've made the attempt to boycott, divest, and sanction Israel synonymous with anti-Semitism, right? So if you even say you want to boycott, divest, and sanction Israel, then you're anti-Semitic is the kind of the political jiu-jitsu that's being played on this issue. But, you know, I think Netanyahu did not consider the negative PR that he would get with this tactic. Is they probably overplayed their hand because it forced everybody but Donald Trump, obviously, to say, okay, hold on, you're going one step too far, and because it brings even more attention to the BDS movement. So it is an opportunity to move the ball forward in that way, kind of as a reaction to their overreaction. But at the same time, it's still the problem still remains with the, you know, and this is, you know, it's difficult to talk about because I'll get some emails at the end of this show or next week when people listen. But it is a testament to the strength of particularly AIPAC in the United States, the ability to control the entire narrative around the meaning behind or trying to draw some type of equality between BDS and anti-Semitism, and you see that stranglehold that it has on the discourse.
I will say, hold on one second. I will say this, that I think AIPAC's influence has diminished amongst Democrats and is diminishing, mm-hmm, without a doubt. I mean, this has been ongoing, but simultaneously over the past 10, 15, 20 years, the Christian Zionist movement, or just broadly speaking, evangelicals. I mean, this is what we're starting to see. And there's also, obviously, from Bibi Netanyahu's perspective, there's obviously some domestic politics at play on his end. But in terms of American politics, this is, we've been on a trajectory here. You can, you could probably track, you know, the, there was a period in this country following, maybe it was the Yom Kippur War or whatever it was. I think it was Yom Kippur War, but the 67 War, where there was broad support for Israel. Israel was considered to be subject to, you know, a lot of hostility around them. And I think there was also, like, you know, not the same level of awareness that people had in terms of, like, who got displaced when, you know, the Balfour Balfour happened. But I think the, so we went through a period where the support for Israel was organic and widely shared. And then as we got into the 80s and following Beirut, and you know, Sharon, and then through the, I think a lot of that support remained intact through the Clinton administration. And but when, you know, Sharon went there and walked on the Temple Mount and crashed the talks, and then we heard the story, you know, the false narrative about 98% of the West Bank was going to be given up. And I've used the example before. It's like you're doing a divorce and it's like, I'm going to give you the entire mansion except for the bathrooms and the kitchen. It doesn't matter that you have 98% of the square footage in the house without the bathroom and the kitchen. And that's basically the deal that was on the table. Then I think AIPAC was very, very prominent. But I think the Christian Zionist movement, and we start to see that shaking out, right? I mean, and Michael can jump in here, that what we've seen in Israel is also sort of mirroring what we're seeing here in terms of where support is coming from Israel. There's been, we have passed, it feels like, some type of threshold where Israel no longer feels like they have to have bipartisan support, or at least, you know, we're seeing that from Netanyahu, I would imagine. Maybe that becomes a talking point in the future, but it's quite clear, you know, even like when Netanyahu showed up and spoke in front of the Republican Congress without an invite, essentially, and we had people like even Tim Kaine not attending that talk, that they're losing the Democratic Party in this country. They're losing support in this country. And so, you know, when that happens, it becomes tighter and
I would say they were actually a forerunner, that you could look at the right in Israel as a precursor to what you see in terms of the United States or India for that matter. But I just want to say, I think it's important just to kind of note maybe like three distinctions inside the Palestinian politics, because you basically have the PLO and the West Bank, who are basically very ineffectual. They're essentially, you know, kind of subcontractors of Israel's security, so-called security needs. And they're, you know, there's all sorts of internal corruption questions. But frankly, they are the only faction left that runs anything that supports the peace process, which, you know, is all in air quotes and hasn't been a real thing for decades, right? And then you have Hamas, which we can object and do object, obviously, to many things that Hamas has done. But Hamas is, you know, running Gaza. And frankly, has, you know, their governance and what they've done has changed radically since they've been in power. And I think that that's just the, you know, reality of governing anything, even to the limited extent they're able to govern. And I do want to say, like,
explain
Omar,
in what way?
Well, I mean, they've radically cut back on terrorist actions, frankly. Yeah. And also they've expressed a willingness to support a two-state solution. And, you know, like, as an example, if, okay, we don't technically recognize Israel, but we'll respect the two-state arrangement for like 100 years type of thing, right? Like very legalistic type of things. I just want to say, though, too, in terms of the origins of BDS, And you're totally right, Sam. There's people who 100% support BDS because they want a genuine two-state bilateral democracy with civil rights for all inside Israel and an authentic Palestinian state. But those that, you know, support, like Omar Barghouti, who's sort of the founding father of it, he, yes, you know, you could say he supports dissolving Israel, quote unquote, but it is not in the sense of, you know, a violent action to uproot Jewish people or harm people. He is just a supporter of the South Africa model. He wants a one state that's secular, democratic, and respects everybody's civil and cultural rights. And frankly, I'll just say that's where I'm at ideologically, because I'm not a big fan of ethnostates of any variety. But we might be getting to, if you could have had a two-state solution several years ago that was authentic and real, that would have been good. But we might be getting to a point where logistically that's the only answer, because the settlements have just expanded and expanded. So how would you actually reset this thing seems logistically kind of impossible.
Well, I mean, look, we've seen in the past that, you know, the Sinai was cleared of settlements. It probably was not nearly as built up.
It's not nearly. I mean, the West Bank has its own entirely new communities. I mean, it's going to be a lot more complicated.
But here's one thing is that, you know, I think it was Frank Bruni wrote some piece the other day in the Times to the effect of, like, BDS hasn't come up with a solution. They won't say if they support a one state or a two state solution. I don't, you know.
Like, it's a broad coalition.
Well, it's a broad coalition. But beyond that, it's like, even that expectation, I you know, was involved, at least in the context of my own college, on divestment of our endowment from companies doing business in South Africa. And the idea that we would have said, like, and what we demand is a Truth and Reconciliation Committee, and specific, this is the way that we want the South African government to be structured, would have been bizarre.
That's exactly right.
It would have been absolutely bizarre. But the bar is being raised here, and it's quite possible that there were people who were interested in divestment who were like, there shouldn't be any white people involved in, you know, Afrikaners should be taken out, you know, should be, you know.
It's funny because, you know, what Thabo Mbeki said, though, about it is he said, you know, he was critiquing the ICC's conduct in Africa. And he said, you know, if the ICC came in and arrested apartheid leaders like de Klerk for crimes against humanity, we would have protested and demand they'd been released immediately because we needed them to negotiate a deal.
Right.
So, exactly.
I mean, it's just like there's a lot of reaching going around, and there's no doubt in my mind, like I said, that there are people who, you know, I would disagree with that support BDS, but BDS is a thing. And, you know, the idea that it's a slippery slope is just, you know, I guess is what the argument is. Like, if you support divestiture, the idea is that divestment is supposed to pressure the Israeli government and to change. And you need an Israeli government to pressure at that point. But I agree with you, Ben, that I think this is probably the best thing that could happen for, you know, for this movement to pressure Israel. I think we're going to see that in the coming years.
Yeah. I like the way you frame that, Sam, because it is moving the goalposts with regard to what a boycott would, the purpose of the boycott, the purpose of divestment, the purpose of sanctions, right? That's the strategy to get to the table, right? That's never been, like, you never put the onus on a person leading a boycott to have all the solutions. But it's not only the moving of the goalposts that's the problem here, but it's also just the framing in general. And I mean, we didn't really get the chance to go into it much, but the role, like you mentioned, the role of Christian Zionists, the role that it plays in right wing politics here in the United States, as well as the support that's happening there in Israel, their ability to still keep and frame this in a way where the mere thought of boycotting Israel is synonymous with anti-Semitism, that has been kind of the stranglehold that has been placed present for a long time. And I will agree with you, right? That ball has moved significantly. Now we do see an opportunity because of this move that the BDS movement is going to get even more support that they would not have gotten had not they banned those two congresswomen.
Yeah.
Though it is mask off. I mean, it's, you know, there is a big element. I'm sorry. Yeah. I just have to say, like, as with Kashmir of and it's been this way when Ehud Olmert went out of government, and I'm not justifying a lot of things he did, but he was the last Israeli prime minister that had an eye on, he would make comments like, American Jews don't like apartheid states. We need to think of how people perceive us in X. And Netanyahu from the beginning was like, I'm a little bit more interested in talking with people like Viktor Orban than, you know, liberal Democrats, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing this all across the, and we should say this is, you know, I have no doubt that this this move by Netanyahu was a function of the elections that are coming up in like 3 or 4 weeks, where he is running against Barak. And I think it's got to be a similar dynamic. Like, he's just motivating his base, who are definitively, you know, a right wing and are motivated by such things. But I think, like, all of this that we're seeing, whether it's, you know, in Brazil, whether it's in Kashmir, whether it's, I mean, China, Hong Kong, that dynamic, I think, has been ongoing. I'm not sure how it plays out there, but certainly Turkey, and obviously Brexit.
Turkey and Israel are the forerunners, I would say, arguably. Yeah,
but there's also a feedback loop here that, you know, the expectations of what a hardline country and regime is, what is expected of them to maintain that status, the bar keeps getting raised because the United States is no longer a force for sort of moderation of the worst elements. And, you know, we saw that with Israel. You know, Israel may have been this is where I would say that the assessment that Israel came first. It was when the Bush administration basically encouraged things like unilateral pullout of Gaza, and invading Beirut. Lebanon, when the Bush administration did this, they stopped being that countervailing force. Mm-hmm. And without the United States as sort of like, you know, when you were a kid and you didn't really want to go to that birthday party, you're like, my mom won't let me go because of I can't go out today. That's what the United States used to be for politicians in Israel. It was,
so we started to amp them up. Come on, guys.
We did the opposite. Yeah. We did the opposite.
Right.
Where we used to be the force that a right-wing politician could say, I can't push it this far because we're butting up against the Americans. Now the Americans were like, push it further. And I think that, you know, it, like in so many instances, some of that starts with us. But I don't know, Ben, anything else to add?
No, great conversation, guys.
Well, always a pleasure. Folks, check out the Benjamin Dixon Show. Where can people watch it and listen to it?
Yeah, I mean, they could go over to the YouTube channel and subscribe to the YouTube channel and get everything they need there. And if they want to listen to the podcast, they can go anywhere a podcast exists. I'm there.
Benjamin Dixon Show. Ben, always a pleasure.
Thanks so much.
Take care,
Ben.
Guys.
Bye. All right, we got to take a break, and when we come back, this is pretty exciting. I want to quote Andy Kindler last night at 6:24 p.m. Pacific time. This is going to be fantastic. We have some, apparently Dennis Miller was on the Ben Shapiro Show.
Bop, bop, bop.
It's like Batman Begins.
Yes, we are there, folks.
Just like that.
We have, our worlds have basically, something has collided. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Andy Kindler.
Yeah.
kiss this guy.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, on the phone, it is always a pleasure to hear from this next guest. But today, even more so, play it.
With a Jew like Andy Kindler, you know you can't go wrong. His ancestors wrote the God Bless America song. The true Obama bot, Andy believes Obama can never be wrong.
Yeah,
Andy Kindler.com. You made me laugh so hard, I had to write you your own theme song. Andy Kindler.
Yes, it's Andy.
Yeah. I feel good. I feel good, even though just in the chat, someone called me a problematic boomer.
Really?
Yeah. They don't like my politics in the chat.
Person. Lame. And that said, you are a problematic boomer, 100%.
Well, I'm not disagreeing. I'm just saying, make it so I can understand it without the $5 words.
Boomer?
Those words are problematic for me.
Yeah. Well, you know, boomers are problematic. You're problematic. I mean, it would not be the first time you've ever been called problematic.
I've been called worse. Am I right? Who's with me? All right.
Everybody,
you know, it's because
when that guy heckled me, remember years ago in the Laugh Factory, he said, this is problematic. He yelled at me, problematic.
It's because you keep calling Chris Cuomo Fredo.
I'll tell you, that's Chris Cuomo thing.
Oh, did we ever play that?
I felt bad for all of us in that one.
Did we ever play that?
No.
Oh, it's so good.
Oh, we should.
We actually never did. It's okay, perfect that we saved it for it. I mean, we didn't play it on
Thursday.
Oh,
it is so good. It is so good.
All right,
my God.
Play it. Do we have that, Matt?
Matt's getting it. Yeah. Hey, Fredo, good job on the show.
Now, wait a minute.
Andy Kindler on Twitter.
Now, we should just set the scene here. Now, I think something's going on because I just read something where Don Lemon is getting sued for getting into a fight with somebody like the Hamptons or something.
Wow.
I have a feeling.
Roided up CNN.
I have a feeling that there could also be a, you know, sort of a concerted effort for people to go and get into altercations with CNN people. That to me seems.
Well, I think it sounds like what happened to me at a Majority Report mixer.
Yeah, exactly.
You step off, I'll smack you.
Here is
I'm for a public option, fellas. Fellas, come on. I like a public option. Get your hand up my yarmulke.
Why don't you respect Obama? Hey, back off.
Yeah, Obama he did the best. He's not a war criminal. Please, fellas, be reasonable.
Here is a clip of Chris Cuomo. Apparently, he's at what function was he at?
I thought it was like, I thought it was a party. Not
I think
he's
just out and
he's
about.
Dressed,
right?
He's dressed
no,
like
but there's
on the
some
way
outdoor
to the gym.
Party. It's like it's in a tent. You can see that because the way that this is shot. Somebody went up to him, and there might have been, I don't know, one or two guys actually involved in this. But they get into it with Chris Cuomo, and here it is. Chris Cuomo, you know, channels his inner tough guy.
And they use the F word. They use the F word.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, let's just try and talk over that so that we don't.
I'm sorry,
no, punk-ass bitches from the right call me Fredo. My name is Chris Cuomo. I'm an anchor on CNN. Fredo is from The Godfather. He was that weak brother.
Isn't that your
And they
brother,
use though? It as an Italian aspersion. Any of you Italian?
It's
a fucking insult to your people.
Yeah!
It's an insult
okay,
to your
fucking
people.
Okay, hold on. Pause it for a second.
I love Chris Cuomo.
Well, but he's like... Does he think that these people don't really know who he is, that they're just calling him randomly, they're calling him Fredo?
Well, didn't the guy did call him Fredo, probably, right?
Well, no, the guy did call him Fredo, but Cuomo is explaining to him, like, well, who Fredo is. Like, what do you think that it's like?
Well, guys, a lot
true.
Of us
that
think...
That is true. There's a little bit... He's out kind of like, I don't know if you're calling me Fredo because you think it's a good nickname, but it's not the right thing.
I think he thinks the guy thinks it's a pasta sauce, like a pasta brand, maybe. That is really funny to patiently explain one of the most iconic characters in movie history.
Well, the reference like, the guy's using.
Fredo was the dumb brother, which you probably don't mean that if you're calling me that in an insulted way.
All right, continue.
It's like the N-word for us. Wow. Is that a cool fucking thing?
Yeah.
You're a much more reasonable guy in person than you seem to be on television.
Yeah, but if you want to play, then we'll fucking play. If you've got something you want to say about what I do on television, say it, but don't give a fuck me.
Hey, man, hey, listen.
What?
I don't want any problems.
Yeah, you're going to have a big fucking problem.
What's the problem?
It's a little different on TV. Don't fucking insult me like that.
I didn't insult you.
The fuck you call me Fredo? It's like I call you punk bitch. You like that? You want that to be your nickname?
Oh.
You call me Fredo. You know my name's not fucking Fredo.
I thought your name was.
You did not think my name was fucking Fredo. Don't be a liar. You want to be a man, stand up like a man.
Standing up, man.
You want to be a man, I'm here. Then fucking own it. Then own what
listen,
you said.
Man. Hey.
Then own what you said.
Listen, take man, I have a problem with you, man.
You're going to have a fucking problem.
What are you going to do about it?
I'll fucking ruin your shit. Then.
Yes.
I can throw you down these stairs like a fucking punk.
Please do.
Why, so you can fucking sue?
You don't want to
So you can fucking sue?
Why don't
you do it? Take a swing. You want to call me Fredo? Take a fucking swing. Take a fucking swing. Watch your fucking hands. Take a swing. Watch your fucking hands.
Why do I have a feeling that Cuomo has his glasses on his shirt?
Yeah.
I love that.
Hey, Fredo, nice coverage of the debates.
Hey, nice readers. Nice readers around you.
Andy Kindler on Twitter.
Hey, Fredo, you're bad at hosting.
Hey, Fredo. Hey, let's get after it, Fredo. That's still my favorite segment.
This would be like almost like if somebody came up to you and called you like
Portnoy
or something. I'm trying to think of like what is the.
Oh my God, that's a bit right there, Sam. At some silly function, you're like, "Hey, Portnoy,
excuse me, did you call me Portnoy? I will wreck you,
Portnoy.
I will wreck you. You keep Philip Roth characters' names out of your damn mouth."
I will guide you down these stairs.
Yeah.
Portnoy was a sexual neurotic and he went to therapy, and that's a very insulting comment on the Jewish people. I will wreck you.
You want me to take you for Fechakta Simis and shove you up the Fechakta? Because I'll do it.
Did you call me Tevya? Excuse me. You know my name's not Tevya. So there it is. Chris Cuomo. And, you know, I gotta think that like for a guy like that he sort of probably likes that occasionally people get a view of him that way, right? Because he feels like he's on, you know, he's on the TV, and he comes off as a soft guy, and he wants to be known.
But
as
he's,
a
not,
hard guy.
He's not. He threw me down the stairs 4 times at a party. Just for saying hi, Chris Cuomo.
But didn't you? You asked him to, though, right?
I said, Chris Cuomo, please throw me down the stairs.
One more time. One more time. Please. One more time, Chris. Please. One more time. Just like.
Oh, what are you going to call me? Portnoy, like a schmuck?
You're going to call me Fiverr Schfinkel? Go ahead. Call me Fiverr Schfinkel to my face.
If you think that I'm some type of masturbator, say it. Say it. Just own it. Just own it.
Oh, because I'm a Jew. I'm a chronic masturbator who calls my mother. That's a very insulting stereotype, sir. I'll throw you down the stairs.
Do you think, like, this is the part that I don't understand about that. And then we'll move on. Do you think...
Move on to Dennis Miller time. That's
yeah,
right.
But wait a second. But Fredo is not a...
Don't say it, goddammit! Do you say Fredo? I'm not a Fredo, you!
But Fredo is not a... Doesn't seem to me to be a like an ethnic slur. It's more of a personal slur, right? Like, people like would call, you know, like one of the Bush brothers at various times Fredo, right? Like, didn't we say, like, oh, it turns out Jeb is Fredo.
Jeb's
we all thought George
Fredo.
Was Fredo.
Yeah.
And, you know, George's obviously son. They're not Italian. It was really more about the dynamic of the brothers. Do you think that he's purposely conflating, you know, like a, I guess Guido would be the term, with Fredo or?
No, because I think he was, as the kids say, loaded for bear that night. You know what I'm saying? You could have said he was ready to go.
He was ready to go. It was go time. It was go time. Yeah.
Can you imagine?
Hey, did you call me a good fella? Did you say I'm a good fella? What are you saying over there?
Right. Imagine Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush, like, hey, that's a slur against the Italian people. That's very offensive. That's like their N word. That's not okay.
Yeah.
Really? Can I speak?
Any time that you're in an argument and you're saying that's our version of the N-word, you're already in trouble.
Right.
When
you
bring making up your own N-word.
All right. Well, let's move on to some real work. So it seems, when was this from, Brendan?
April.
Wow. We were.
I'm not Brendan. I'm sorry.
No, I mean, I wanted Brendan to let us know. I feel like we really dropped the ball here. Dennis Miller, back when he was on his tour, and I think we did some other stuff from his big tour at that time, his, you know, Dennis Miller 3.0 tour, where he had sort of shifted at 2.7. He was no longer political, and then he went back to political when he realized, like, nobody cares about me if I'm not political at all. And so
these are the post-Riley years.
Yeah. This is the post Riley years. He's really wandering in the desert in many respects, and he found himself at sitting down with Ben Shapiro. Let's take this first clip. I don't know. We're just going to run. You guys have the clips, so let's just run these.
This is on AOC.
You shouldn't see it that way. So I'm about where I should be at 65 is the way I look at it.
I don't want to turn this into sort of a nostalgia play or you grousing about the young, but I look at AOC in the same way that I look at some of the comedians that I see working today.
You're
and that is enthusiasm over skill. Do you get that impression also? I look at AOC in the same way that I look at some of the comedians that I see working today, and that is enthusiasm over skill. Do you get that impression also that there's a real draw toward the enthusiastic and the authentic as opposed to the craft, like actually working through things?
Well, the I think is, listen, there's some guys who are beautiful technicians.
Wait, pause it for a second. So he's trying to make this argument about AOC, and Miller, of course, picks it up in terms of comedy. What would be the craft that AOC lacks when she has just unseated one of the most powerful Democrats in the House at this point in April and continues to have, she is now like the number 3 fundraiser, I think, in the Democratic caucus. Like, what craft do you think that Ben Shapiro thinks that AOC doesn't have?
And she's doing this while being funnier than Dennis Miller, just in those little videos she makes, right? She is truly funny, and he's jealous of her because of her humor.
All right, let's hear Dennis Miller's response.
Well, the craft, I think, is, listen, there's some guys who are beautiful technicians, and they literally would do syllable counts and peel it back, but something,
syllable the main counts, director, I love obviously. It.
And K's, right? You got to use K a lot, right?
You do syllables.
Some guys, first of all, everything he says in this whole thing, because I listened to the whole hour and 8 minutes, everything is a lie, including that there are guys who count syllables. Not one comic counts syllables. So they may do laughs per minute or something like
so
that.
So I already called him Fredo once. What do I do next? What's a good? What is going to rhyme with Fredo?
Dough. Fredo. Okay, so that's two. I want to do. I want this to land with like 47 syllables. Go.
Authentic, as opposed to the craft, like actually working through things.
Well, the craft, I think, is, listen, there's some guys who are beautiful technicians, and they literally would do syllable counts and peel it back. But something, the main directive, obviously, like comedy's always been getting laughs. Now, you can go out and do it in a myriad of ways. There are physical comedians. There are, intellectual comedians. You see some guys and you think, wow, that's so smart. But for the most part, it's all about the prime directive of getting laughs. I've noticed the change is more tectonic in that it's turned everybody's comedy act almost into an impersonator act. Like impressionists used to do, they go, what if Jack Nicholson was working at the Burger King? And I was always bridal. I lacked that gene where I could go with that, where I'd say, time out, he's one of the highest paid actors in the world. Why is he working at a fast food place? I couldn't even go there. But they do it, and then at the end, people applaud. And that's sort of what humor is now. Like, people will make a bold statement and get applause instead of big laughs. That's weird to me. It's sort of short-circuited the primal thing, that it's an involuntary gesture where somebody says something funny and you don't have to intellectualize it. You just find yourself, and that's the cool part.
But wait a second.
Now
wait
it's
a second.
People going.
Wait a second. Pause it.
All I'm saying is that you are really... This next segment where Ben Shapiro on comedy is maybe the greatest thing I've ever heard.
All right, but wait, before we go into this, let me get this straight. Dennis Miller, who built his entire career on what people perceive to be cleverness, right? Like, there's no gut, visceral laughter of like, this guy had more lint on him than a battleship that had just come back from picking up some tribbles or something. Like, his whole career was based on cleverness, not gut laughs.
Count the syllables.
Right.
All right, go ahead.
Right.
It's an involuntary gesture where somebody says something funny and you don't have to intellectualize it. You just find yourself. And that's the cool part of it. Now it's people going, And so that's a big change for comedy. Yeah.
Well, the term that I've heard used about this is clapter, that people are not actually laughing anymore. They're just they're clapping. And this is the Hannah Gadsby version of comedy, where you have think pieces now about why for thousands of years we've actually been getting the entire concept of comedy wrong. It's not that we're supposed to laugh at things. It's supposed to, if we laugh at things, it's actually bad. We're supposed to think about things, and then the thinking is the humor. It seems to me that we are reshifting the entire nature of humanity around what a bunch of very politically driven people want it to be. Because, I mean, I'm old enough to remember when Jay Leno was on television and trying to be funny, and now you've got people on TV in late night who I don't even know if they're trying to be funny anymore. I mean, legitimately. I think that Fallon may be the only late night host who's even making an occasional attempt to be funny. I don't know what your opinion is of the current late night crowd.
I think Jimmy's a great entertainer, and I like that about him.
I still like to get on.
I think that you have to understand if you want to...
Pause it. Wait a second. So I'm just... Andy, I want you to go, but he's complaining about people doing political comedy, which is all that Dennis Miller has been doing for 16, 17 years now, and he cites the one thing he cites to try and argue that people used to be funny is Jay Leno.
Well, that's the thing. Ben Shapiro, he goes,
I'm old enough to remember when Jay Leno was on television and trying to be funny. Yeah, I do too. When he took the show away from Letterman and he wasn't funny for the rest of his life. I mean, he's using Leno as an example. But the other thing is he says it very quickly, though. This is the Hannah Gadsby version of comedy where we get think pieces. We're not supposed to laugh at things. It's just a complete she does a show where she talks about how she had this, she came to this part in her life where she didn't want to do the stuff that she was doing before. And he's making it like there's a Hannah Gadsby school of comedy where all you do is think pieces. I mean, it literally is amazing how out of touch both of them are.
Great critique of Hannah Gadsby in The New Yorker, though, I will say that. I have to just put it in.
I haven't read that yet, but oh, no, I did see that.
It was very good. It was a very un-Fredo piece, Andy. Don't start harassing the person who wrote the New Yorker review.
Would you call me?
Okay. I called you Portnoy.
Keep going.
Finding Jimmy's a great entertainer, and I like that about him. I think that you have to understand if you want to, at some point you would lose those jobs if you, look how good Jimmy is at it, Jimmy Fallon. I've been on Jimmy.
We can probably move to the next clip, actually.
Yeah,
all right. Let me just say one thing, though. He argues that Fallon got in trouble for doing pro-Trump material, like the fluffing of his hair. I mean, it's just incredible. He thinks that was that Jimmy would do pro Trump material, but he's afraid to.
This is about Trump's proletarian chops.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Dad, who's the Boilermaker who never got anywhere near that. I always think, wow, in an odd way, the most patrician of these guys, or I shouldn't say patrician, but the billionaire guy comes in. And he has a stranglehold on what the hoi polloi mean. I'm fascinated by that. I think it was all those years of him in a hard hat walking through construction sites.
Oh, my God.
With the power tie on. But he also has to cohabitate with all these cats who are throwing the building up, or he has nothing. Gave him these proletariat chops, which I admire about him. You know, whenever they say, just this morning.
Proletariat chops.
Well, I should let you ask questions, but I'm off on some rant here. But I saw again this morning that.
I mean,
did you know that look up the word patrician? Look up the word patrician. He refers to Trump as an aristocrat, and then he takes it back. Well, maybe I shouldn't say he's a patrician.
Right.
We do have some Hitler talk coming up too here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the Hitler
rant here. But I saw again this morning that a couple of Democratic candidates, Castro, I forget his name, is it Julian or
Julian Castro.
Castro and. Somebody else said Trump reminds him of the Third Reich.
Yeah, Beto.
Beto. And I always look at this stuff and I think, oh, for God's sakes, do you not see that you're not being clever about how you're playing this guy? If you do hate him, if you do hate what he wants, if you want him
out. If you do.
To throw down the Hitler thing. And then here's even the backup plan on that. When you say he's Hitler-like, obviously my flashcard in my head is the systematic liquidation of 6 million of his fellow human beings. I haven't seen anything like that from Trump. And they'll say, oh, of course I didn't mean that. And you'll say, well what other Hitler peccadillo were you seizing on? You know, the shitty mustache, the bad house painter reviews on Angie's List. Of course when you say Hitler. So again, this morning, even today, you've got Beto O'Rourke's positing himself as a young hipster. A young hipster does not come in and say the man in the Oval Office right now, to me, it's such an awkward, clumsy overplay, is like Adolf Hitler.
Okay.
What is the syllable count on that, guys?
This is unbelievable. This guy is, this is of course before the El Paso shooting, and this is, he's talking about nobody in camps. This guy is literally a moron who doesn't even know what Trump is doing. He has no idea what's happening.
Well, it's
embarrassing.
First of all, he also doesn't know how many people died in the Holocaust. He's only talking about the Jews. There was another 3 million who were exterminated. But
he wants to wait till they're all exterminated. He goes, "Tell me after they've killed 6 million people." That's like seems to be what he's saying.
But this is this is a broad, for Dennis Miller, who I think at one point in his career tried to sell himself as the thinking man's comedian. This is the problem with our understanding of what fascism is, right? Like, it's that he was fascistic and that he had to go through certain thresholds to bring about that kind of stuff. And,
right.
And, you know, who else are you going to point to, right? Like, he you know, Trump's like Franco. Nobody's going to know who you're talking about. Like, you know, there's
Yeah. Because he's actually more like he actually looks similar to Mussolini, if you ever actually look at Trump. But the point of him saying, the fact is that Dennis Miller literally does not want, he knows now this is his audience. So he'll lie, he'll say anything to pretend that this guy is good. It's really sickening. He spends the whole hour basically saying how great Trump is, because I think he's saying the other comics are afraid. They're afraid to go against Trump. He's afraid to go. He's afraid to do anything because he's trapped in this horrible, unfunny character.
Do you think that's? Basically like I need one more priming of the pump of my career, and so that's what this tour was about. Let's keep rolling.
Oh, we're gonna skip ahead here to where Miller talking about a great Monday Night Football joke he did.
I knew I wasn't long for that one because I was trying to shoehorn what I do, which is Weird Arcania, into the National Football League game. I remember they'd get mail like,
I just want to remind you that earlier he was bemoaning the fact that comedy is no longer about sort of visceral laughs.
Primal.
And he's talking about doing Weird Arcania, which is not exactly the huge guffaw jokes, but go ahead.
In the National Football League game, I remember they'd get mail like, what is he talking
about? What
was
that reference?
Plantagenets. I remember, are we on cable? Can you say?
You can say whatever you want. Yeah.
Okay, I'll tell you a great story. We're doing a game one night, and this receiver hurts his ankle.
Yeah, say something
funny.
They're
wrapping it in an ace bandage, and on the air, I try to make Al laugh, and the Weird Arcania is what makes him laugh. Because Al's a genius, but if you throw him off his feet, he can't gather it, and he's like a tipsy air traffic controller. It gets a little weird, so I spend all my time trying to get him to laugh. So they show him wrapping the ankle, and I go, you know, Al, I haven't seen that much fabric used since the environmental artist Christo wrapped the Pont Neuf Bridge in Paris. And I remember Al hits his sneeze button, which cuts his voice out to the home viewer. He looks at us.
Al Michaels is a genius. As we all know, Al Michaels is an absolute genius. I mean, this guy is like, he thinks because he got the Christo reference, they're all celebrating in the booth.
Yeah, but also, this keeps cutting against exactly everything he said in the first half of the interview, which is like, you know, people are now just looking for a clap. Like, there's nothing.
That's right. Oh, my God. He got the Christo reference. He's good.
Yeah, the Christo reference. Oh, my God. You can see everybody just guffawing. No, it's like, oh, he's clever. He knew about that that art installation.
Did you ever see him on Monday Night Football? He was the absolute worst. He was it made me hate words and commentary for years afterwards. He was just awful. Awful.
I think that's actually where the term conversation ender was coined. Go, what do we got next? More of that?
Is that more of this? There's more of this little clip here.
Okay.
Because Al's a genius, but if you throw him off his feet, he can't gather it. And he's like a tipsy air traffic controller. It gets a little weird. So I spend all my time trying to get him to laugh. So they show him wrapping the ankle. And I go, you know, Al, I haven't seen that much fabric used since the environmental artist Christo wrapped the Pont Neuf Bridge in Paris. And I remember Al hits his sneeze button, which cuts his voice out to the home viewer. He looks
at the sneeze button. The sneeze button. He hits the sneeze button.
Olmeyer, our producer's down in the truck, and he fancies himself an art aficionado. I actually hear him say, no, Al, Christo, environmental artist, good call. And I remember simultaneously delighting in that and thinking, I'm not long for this. Because you can't, you know, they're watching football. I would have whacked me, too. It was like when I heard Madden left Fox, I called Fouts.
Can I just say one thing? The comics today don't, if you laugh every time you open up your mouth, you are the biggest hack in the history of the world. He literally laughs every sentence. He can't stop cracking himself up.
Environmental artist Christo.
He gets it. He gets it.
As like I told Jimmy Fallon.
That story sounds an awful lot like a story about producers like coming to their wits' end and like, yeah. I mean, he kind of has some self-awareness about that, but I feel like if you were in the room, you'd be like, yeah, everyone's sick of Dennis Miller's crap.
Everybody's sick of his nonsense.
Like, why does Dennis Miller need to show?
6 minutes later, you don't have to say this, but 6 minutes later, he says, "I'm reading Atlas Shrugged again as we speak."
Are you serious? And let's also like the wrapping of the Pont-Neuf, and I think this happened in sometime in the 80s, because I think I was in college at this time.
Oh my god!
But
here we go.
But that would have been, I think, contemporaneous with his work, but. It couldn't have been more than 5 or 6 years early. I mean, it wasn't like that's a really arcane reference. It was just a really inappropriate reference. It wasn't like you were digging deep, like, wow, you really know your art history. You're aware of that massive outdoor installation, which got a lot of coverage. It's like, you know, I don't know. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that this idea, like you said, the idea that people get the reference and therefore that's the joke, and that it's like when people go, "Oh, you didn't get my dust." Like, I've heard comics do something like, they go, "Dostoevsky." "Oh, you didn't get my Dostoevsky reference." I mean, what kind of world are we living in want people to be proud of you because you can reference a Russian author?
Sorry, I didn't get your Tolstoy reference, Portnoy. Oh.
One of my opening jokes back in the day when I had a little more facial hair was to do the old, "Hey, folks, I know you're looking at me and you're saying, what the hell is Andre Brisson doing up there?"
I don't know who that is. Who is that?
That is good.
Some random French philosopher. Random
I know what you people are thinking. When did Horshack marry someone who doesn't look like Horshack?
I mean, it was completely, I was just mocking people who would do that. That was all I was doing. I was just being a...
It's like all of my comedy was about...
All of my comedy
we didn't call it subtweeting then, but it was subtweeting other comedians.
No, all of my comedy was actually just subtweeting the audience. Like, how dare you?
Good evening. I hate you and the other performers.
Exactly. For the next 20 minutes, I will tell you how much I hate you, but the word hate will never cross my lips. Go.
Here he is on the Iran deal and Obama.
Oh, God.
Oh, this is the best.
Let's stick to installation art, all right? God.
Stu, as I got older, it just didn't make sense to me anymore, some of that stuff. And as I get older yet, it still doesn't make sense to me. Listen, they always say, oh, Trump's insane. And I guess Obama's held up as the avatar of, you know, wisdom in that. And
lack of insanity.
Who loads 1.8 billion onto a pallet and sends it to Iran? I mean, I'm kind of, people say, that's so naive. I can hear John Kerry say, and I go, well, you overthink it. I just know they live to kill the Jews. Oh. I dig the Jews. I'm not even Jewish, but I dig the Jews just because they live in the craziest cul-de-sac in the world. And anytime you prepackage 1.8, just the fact that they would ask for it in cash, I'd say, why don't I just give you a check and fill the memo section on kill Jews? You know what I mean? It's obviously, anytime you send an unmarked cash to Iran, some of it's going to end up bombing a Sbarro pizza parlor. That stuff doesn't make sense to me. And I can't fake like it does. I have to stop down
on
each issue.
The stuff you just said didn't make sense. Is that what he's saying?
First off, can I just say, in terms of style, the idea that you would in 2019 say without irony, "I dig the Jews," and they
I know because they live in the crazy
slack.
Someone's got to put that as a meme. They live in the craziest cul-de-sac on earth, man. It's crazy over there.
So we got Portnoy over here living in the crazy cul-de-sac. That guy's just trying to jerk off and work out his mom issues, and the Iranians are trying to blow him up. So I dig him.
I dig the Jews. Look, I dig them. I dig the Jews. This is a Palestinian cat saying this, and the other guy saying that.
And here he is on Obama spending.
That is funny, though. John Kerry, like, let's fill out the memo line. Go at the Jews. All right, deal signed.
I would say.
And he ignores that there's an Iran deal. He hasn't even mentioned that there's a nuclear deal.
Right.
Like, he hasn't even
understand
that.
We just dropped them off. It was cash also that we owed them, frankly. But,
yeah.
He has turned out to be very conservative. I mean, he's led, I would say, on most big issues. You're more conservative than me. I'm pretty conservative. But, you know, he's done pretty well as far as checking conservative boxes, hasn't he?
Well, certainly with regard to tax cuts, with cutting regulation, with appointing conservative judges, moving the embassy to Jerusalem.
That's a big ticket.
He's done a lot of great stuff. I mean, the one area where I think the Republican Party continues to be a giant fail is, of course, on spending and entitlements. And they will be a fail for as long as any party can be a fail.
Yeah, he has failed on that. This is the reason stuff that I think he can talk about where they should talk about it with him. Yeah, we're spending our ass off. I don't think we're spending at the same speed that we did under Obama, but certainly it's not enough of a thing where you go, oh, he's notched back on that. I think that
we are.
I can't.
Not at all.
Oh my God.
We are. We're spending more.
Unbelievable. He doesn't have a fact in his head. He literally is a stupid. I'm sorry to say this. He's a profoundly stupid man.
It's true. And let me just make this clear. The deficit may have increased, although I don't think that's even the case anymore. But the deficit, when it increased, was a function of tax revenues going down. And then the tax cuts that came in the form of the stimulus package, the spending was only half of that. And we're spending far more now. We just added 10 years worth of Pentagon spending at $700 billion.
Yeah. And how can you? I mean, it is sad to me. And it's not sad. He's just such a moron that he literally doesn't care enough. He's too self-absorbed to care about what the actual facts are of anything.
He's sort of like a non-Italian Fredo posing as a Portnoy. You know,
he's like a Fredo. He's like a Fredo without a brother.
He's like an only child Fredo. Worst of all worlds right there.
Exactly. Do we have any more?
You can't even say that to your brother. You're sitting alone in your room going, I'm smart.
I think that's about
Not like everybody says.
No, he does say at the end, though, he says, he goes, a loofah scrub. He uses a loofah scrub on his brain. He also claims that, Ben Shapiro claims the only jokes you can do are sex jokes now. This is all a bunch of garbage.
What?
I'm sorry. He claims that the only jokes you can do are sex jokes. Or just leftist commentary you can watch on Matto. Like, he thinks Matto is a comic? And then someone says it's Jenny McCarthyism.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Hi, this is Rachel Maddow. What do you call a Vladimir Putin orchestrated threesome?
All right, I think I found that Maddow stuff.
Operation.
Here we go.
Around 3 o'clock,
I can actually see
after
that.
Hearing that story, around 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, I'm going to be doing some yard work. And if there's anybody else in the crowd who wants to drive by and put a f***ing bullet in me, because I'm dead like him, I'm dead.
Not sure what this is about.
And the people were like, it was like the beginning of The Mask or something, where the eyes are coming out, and that's. Now, looking back at that, that's the hardest I've ever left. I remember thinking, I was with a comedian named Jeff Cesario. Now, I look back on that. I don't have any choice in that. I look back on it. Is it like great moments in comedy? No, it's not exactly deft, but it was just so wrong. And the equilibrium was so thrown off.
It sounds
maybe
really
it was
funny.
Nervousness, but it just made me laugh my ass off. And I often think now, all that's dead. Sam would be out of the business today. So would Rickles. I mean, I think
he's pointing at Sam Kennison line and claiming that nobody could do that line today. And then he also says Pepperidge Farm Milanos as a reference to Alyssa Milano. I mean, he's on the cutting edge,
But you know, here's the thing that is if Rickles or Sam Kennison were alive today, their comedy would be different.
Absolutely. Right?
Like the idea that their comedic brains had no sense of what was going on around them at the time. I mean, I think you look back on Don Rickles in the era he was doing it. It was a very different social scene. And
he also was a fun. I'm kind of biased towards him because he actually was hilarious. And he was a little bit. He was a little. I mean, his stuff. If he was starting now, he would not be. Have the outdated, molded ideas. Like, he was someone's like Archie Bunker in a way, but he was completely, not trying to be mean about it. But he would change, yeah.
No, I mean, there was in that era, there were taboos about language that don't exist today.
In
the, like today, concepts exist. The taboos that are there are a function of how they implicate other people. They're not a pretense, right? Like the taboos on language during that era, right? That Lenny Bruce spent a lot of time, you know, dealing with, had to do with trying to convince people that certain things to gaslight people, right? Like, you know,
right.
Lenny Bruce did that famous N-word.
Yeah.
And that was because he was railing against, he wasn't doing that because he wanted to say that word. He was trying to do that because he's saying, like, look, this sentiment exists out there. And this is the reality. We can, you know, by not saying this word on stage, we're trying to pretend that there's no racism or that this word isn't used. But
I thought they were just using the word. But
Rickles, I think, in many respects, was doing the same thing. He was.
Well, also, I'm sorry to interrupt, but Kennison, for example, Kennison, I mean, I never saw Kennison live, but when Kennison was doing things like, you know, why are these people in the desert, you know, the problem with the people in the desert, they should move to the food. I mean, that was social. He was doing social commentary, and he absolutely would be able to do that material today. And just like Bill Hicks, yeah, his image of who he thinks Kennison is or his image of all these people are so distorted because he doesn't remember when he was maybe edgy for a day and a half, which he was at some point.
And it was also a function of the time. I mean, frankly, you know, my sense is, and I, you know, the older I get, the more I think this is the case, is that good comedy does not stand the test of time very well in a way that drama does, because so much of it is a specific critique of the moment and of, you know, there's some comedy that deals with, you know, sort of like, more about, you know, sort of relational dynamics, but that are, you know, about emotions that exist through time. But so much of good comedy in the moment is that it's capturing the moment and it's capturing what people, you know, believe. Like a lot of the industry reports that you have done 15 years ago, you know, unless you live through that era.
Right, you wouldn't. The references, you're not going to.
It's not going to mean anything. And you know, I mean, I see it even with my, you know, with my own, you know, the time capsules of comedy, that in the moment, you know, stuff that we thought 20 or 30 years ago was going to be timeless, just it's not. It turns out.
Well, for example, I still every night say, "Who died made Jim Belushi a big star." I say that every night, and I don't think people know they'll know who Jim Belushi or John Belushi is.
Exactly.
And I still enjoy
Jim Belushi is because of this show.
Exactly.
I think we got a little bit more on the segment if we want to go for it.
Let's just do it.
Rickles. I mean, I think Rickles might get through because he was a softie. He had a good heart. But Sam was just flat. Sam had a good heart, but he was more malevolent. I don't think either of those guys could work now, and that's a weird place to be in.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to ask you next. Is about
They're
the
also
modern
both
standards.
Dead, which means that they couldn't work now, but go ahead.
Could work now, and that's a weird place to be in.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to ask you next, is about the modern standards. You know, it seems to me that we've actually returned to a sort of puritanism.
Is that a fake voice? I can't believe, is this Ben Shapiro really a darling of the right? I can't imagine somebody who has less to say, even provocatively, say something to insult me at least.
Hey, what do you think of the new comics today? Are they not so good, right?
Andy Kindler's a real Fredo.
Yeah. The modern standards. You know, it seems to me that we've actually returned to a sort of puritanism about comedy,
yes.
Where if the only jokes that you're allowed to make are basically sex jokes, all the other jokes are out the window because they rely on stereotypes or they rely on observations about reality that could be offensive to somebody. Sex is inherently funny, so you can make a sex joke and get away with it, or you can just shock somebody by cursing or things.
What?
Hey, I'm not folding it in half for anybody. 6 inches, I'm not folding it in half for anybody. People love these dick jokes. I got a dick, and that's the only thing I can get left. I mean, that's
what does that
pretty
mean?
Good.
Sex is inherently funny. Oh, I forgot. Ben Shapiro has the sexual awareness of a junior high student. That's what.
My wife is a doctor, so as you can imagine, it's even more funny that way. So every time we have sex, it's really a form of playing doctor. I mean, the jokes are right themselves.
I mean, that's what I was going to ask you next, is about the modern standards. You know, it seems to me that we've actually returned to a sort of Puritanism about comedy, yes. Where if the only jokes that you're allowed to make are basically sex jokes, all the other jokes are out the window because they rely on stereotypes or they rely on observations about reality that could be offensive to somebody. Sex is inherently funny, so you can make a sex joke and get away with it, or you can just shock somebody by cursing or saying something incredibly lewd or vulgar. But it seems like it's either that or you know, probing social commentary, meaning just leftist social commentary you could watch on Maddow. So is there a future for comedy in this world?
Maddow.
Comedy is
Maddow's leftist social commentary. That's the only thing you can do. Unless you want to do sex jokes.
What do you call a Russian penis enlargement surgery?
Unbelievable.
You know what I mean? Something's going to happen in this country that's going to uncap this pressure. What was the guy's name? Ray Donovan. Where do I go to get my reputation back? Or I think there was a guy named Walsh who one time said, "Have you no shame?" You know, Hollywood's running the tightest Torquemada type thing now. It's not McCarthyism. It's like Jenny McCarthyism. You know, you can be kicked out in a second for saying something wrong, supposedly by the cool kids. That makes me. I never thought I'd see that coming. And now I can't say how I see it going, but I do think there'll be some moment where something is overplayed, somebody has harangued. It might almost happen with Monica Lewinsky, but she saved that dress. I mean, when you look back on that, people always say, "That's just an odd
relax."
Thank God.
He's got to lie down.
What is he talking about? It's just like almost like everything that he had planned, he didn't get to. He's just trying to dump it into the last couple of minutes of the interview.
Yeah, I don't
know. Did I mention
and at the end,
blue dress?
At the end, he says Ben Shapiro is brilliant. That's my favorite part.
Oh. Well, we don't need to watch that.
That's probably it.
Yeah. Well, that was good.
And then I say to my wife, is it time for another physical? I mean, you could just see the jokes. Just, it's almost unfair.
You know, I mean, I feel like we say this every time, but Dennis Miller just seems so tired that it's almost like he's not providing the energy that we need to mock him in some ways. And I find that a little bit upsetting.
Ben Shapiro.
Yeah, that is a little bit upsetting because if you watch this whole hour and 8 minutes, first of all, the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life is Ben Shapiro right in the middle of an interview. He goes, do you have problems going to the post office? Well, then you can go to stamps.com. And stamps.com is the place to go. Now, Dennis, what do you think? How'd you get your start? I mean, it's literally, he turns. It really is great. It's fantastic. Hey, do you have to hire people? ZipRecruiter. Hire people, ZipRecruiter. Now, Dennis, how did you first get to Saturday Night Live?
We do. Ben Shapiro does not seem to have like any sense of where it's appropriate to do ads. Didn't he do something?
At the March for Life.
He did a March.
Yeah, the March for Life.
Ad.
In the middle,
he did a mid-roll ad.
What was the ad that he did? Like,
there's a genocide of babies, and now that's why I want to talk with you about a new nutraceutical. Because if you save those babies' lives, you're going to want to give them brain nutrients.
Remember when the right wing guys would always like advertise Hannity? We like go back to my PC, you know, like all this genius stuff that the right wing people are saying. They don't want to lose it, so we have a special memory stick.
Oh my God, it was for Quip, Sam. Right? It was for Calm.
I thought it was Quip.
For Calm.
Well, HuffPost is saying it was for Calm, the sleep meditation.
Like the second leading cause of death after the genocide of babies is stress, according to WHO.
Oh, he had his recruiter on there,
fascism
too.
Making Quip you a little too. Jumpy?
Unbelievable.
If you're jumpy because you're a fascist, then maybe you need to calm down at night with some herbal tea.
Yeah, so Calm was the ad read, and then he did a ZipRecruiter one, too, and then Quip actually pulled their sponsorship because he read the other ones during it. So,
oh, my God. Good for them.
Quip.
Good for them. good for them.
Wonder.
Andy... What's next for you?
Oh,
What's next for me? You want to know what's next for
thought,
me?
Thought spiral,
people are talking, 10 to 20 to 30, maybe 40 people are talking about my podcast with J. Elvis Weinstein and Thought Spiral. It's sweeping the nation. If sweeping the nation means the 30 people total throughout the nation, but it's really good.
Have you done, listen, I don't want to make this about my own personal pettiness. Have you done any Bob's Burgers lately?
I've done a couple of, I hate to get technical, ADRs. I don't even know what that means.
Additional
dialogue recorded.
Dialogue recording, yeah.
So it's usually when they have another line for me, or my new hope is that they want to redo the lines that I've done. So now I'm going to, if I do get more, I'm going to tank them.
You know
so
what?
I do that.
I do that occasionally. Like I'll do like I'm going to mumble this one and see if I can get called back.
But is there a movie? Are we going to be in a movie, Sam? I have heard no word about the movie.
That's why I was afraid to ask, but I'm glad to hear you have not heard anything. I have not heard anything. So there's still a chance.
What's the
and we'll
Jewish
be back
version?
With two frightened guys hoping that they're going to get a voiceover after these messages.
What's the Jewish version of calling somebody Fredo? Portnoy. I'll explain when we get back.
Andy.
Philip Roth wrote about
I hope everybody's listening to Thought Spiral and are going to go check out your show. When's your next show? Sometime in...
I've got a full schedule. Are you saying that I don't have a full schedule?
Andy
because
Kindler.
I really do.
Com.
And I'm going to be in Toronto in September.
All right.
Well, reading Atlas Shrugged from the stage.
I want people to go up, finally. Say hi to Andy. So all the Majority Report listeners up in Toronto. We got a big Toronto crew up there.
Yes.
Andy,
yes.
Always a pleasure.
Love you guys.
Thank Love you, Andy. Buddy.
Have a good weekend. Bye-bye.
All right, folks. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll head into the fun half. I do have a post roll, don't I?
Yes,
Where did
you
that
do.
Go? Oh, here it is. Don't forget, you can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com, jointhemajorityreport.com, wherein you can support this program. And by saying thank you, we also give you, in our attempt to say thank you, we give you extra content every single day. This episode is brought to you. Are we going to do this afterwards? How are we going to do this? Let's do it now.
Okay.
This episode is brought to you by Blinkist. The Blinkist app takes the key takeaways from thousands of best-selling nonfiction books and condenses them down to just 15 minutes for you to read or listen to. 10 million people are using Blinkist right now. It has a massive and growing library from self-help and business to health and history books with just the key takeaways. Right now, you can get 25% off your first year at Blinkist.com/majority. That's Blinkist.com/majority. 25% off your first year. Don't forget, jointhemajorityreport.com. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Check out our AM Quickie. Michael, TMBS this week.
TMBS on Tuesday, Shahid Buttar, who's challenging Nancy Pelosi, and Anna Kasparian. Also,
was that last Tuesday?
Excuse me, I'm plugging this coming Tuesday. Last Tuesday was Breonna Joy Gray, Bernie Sanders' press secretary, TMBS crew, and also Elaine Yu of the AFP on the Hong Kong uprisings. Patreon.com/TMBS, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. And today we will cross our first 69,000 subscribers. Grab your tickets to see us in Chicago next Saturday, too.
I spoke to Shahid Buttar on...
you said you were very impressed.
On Ring of Fire. Yeah, he's an extremely sharp guy.
I'm excited for that interview.
Very sharp guy. Great politics, too. Matt?
Well, quick plug for Jamie. She's going to be on with Hassan Piker at 3:30 today at TYT.com. For Literary Hangover, we problematize Orwell in the next edition of our Orwell reading series. Talk about how he sort of centers the white man in his anti-colonial writings. We're doing the essay "Shooting an Elephant," which is, besides the racist attitudes, a good essay.
Total Portnoy.
All right, quick break. Fun half.
Left is best.
J. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabs.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up. Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.